Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vizor.
I'm Dan Pfeiffer.
And here's our interview with President Barack Obama. Well, welcome back to Pod Save America. Thanks for doing this.
It is great to be with you guys. Good to see you.
All right, we're going to start with the midterms. We're getting serious here.
Yes.
So these midterms, are like 2010, are happening in, we would say, a suboptimal economic environment. But sort of unlike 2010, Democrats have a handful of pretty powerful arguments that seem to be moving voters about who Republicans are.
Right.
On one hand, you got a bunch of big lie believing insurrectionists. So that's one argument.
Right.
Another argument is about extremism on abortion, gay marriage, contraception, et cetera.
Right.
And then also Republicans who want to get back to Congress to cut taxes for the wealthy, pay for by cutting Social Security and Medicare. You're about to get out on the campaign trail. Do you think there's a way to sort of weave those things into one narrative about the stakes in this election?
Well, look, I think the first and most important issue is, are we going to preserve and hopefully strengthen our democracy? And that's sort of a baseline question. And I believe that given how at least Republican officials have behaved, they increasingly are willing to subvert basic democratic procedures, right? Like, let's count votes. Let's make sure that people are allowed to vote. Let's make sure that whoever gets the most votes has the most seats, and that if they get the most votes in Congress, that you can pass laws, right? Basic stuff like that they don't increasingly seem to believe in. And so that's the sense of urgency that I have. Now, I think for the average voter out there, we can talk about specific issues that are important to them. And this has been a long-term battle that we've been having between Democrats and Republicans. And that is, do we create the kind of economy that gives everybody a fair shot and that grows the economy in a way that is good for not just a few, but the many. And the great thing that I think we have going for us is that even with really slim majorities, what we've shown is that we can deliver. The Biden administration has accomplished a lot. You've got a historic infrastructure bill that's going to help rebuild America and create jobs all across the country. You've got an Inflation Control Act that has lowered prescription drug prices, has made sure that healthcare is even more affordable through the ACA, that is looking at lowering energy costs. You've got a gun bill that is the first major piece of gun safety legislation that we've seen in 30 years. Across the board, what we've seen is that when Democrats have a working majority or even a really slim majority in Congress, they can make people's lives better. And so if you combine the deep concerns about our democracy with the concrete accomplishments that this administration had been able to deliver because we had a narrow majority in both the House and the Senate, that should be enough to inspire people to get out. Now, there's one last piece of business that I think has been on a lot of people's minds, and that's Dobbs, right? The overturning of Roe versus Wade. Because what that also indicates is that a lot of rights that we've taken for granted, won through enormous struggle and mobilization over the last 40, 50 years, those aren't rights that we can take for granted. If Roe versus Wade can be overturned, then it's likely that a significant part of this Supreme Court is less concerned about issues of privacy and personal freedom generally, which means that LGBTQ rights can be at risk. It means that basic precepts about the state staying out of how we think about family and relationships, that those are all called to question. And yeah, it's been interesting talking to, I think, a lot of young people who, even though they thought, were frustrated with the lack of progress in some areas, they had never gone through the experience of seeing us go backwards on a big issue. And it's a reminder that democracy is fragile, that you have to tend to it, you have to fight for it. And this midterm election, I think, is going to be a moment in which, you know, that battle has to be joined, and that means people have to turn out.
So Donald Trump has made himself a central character in these midterms.
He has.
He has. He's made it pretty clear he wants to run again. Even if he doesn't, he's clearly remade the Republican Party in his image. What lessons have you learned in the last couple of years about how we can defeat not only Trump, but Trumpism long term?
Well, the thing that I think sometimes we seem to make mistake on is his behavior can be so outrageous, and now folks who try to copy him and his outrageous behaviors get a lot of attention. And so we join that game, and we spend enormous amounts of time and energy and resources pointing out the latest crazy thing he said, or how rude or mean, you know, some of these Republican candidates behaved. That's probably not something that in the minds of most voters overrides their basic interests. Can I pay the rent? What are gas prices? How am I dealing with childcare, et cetera, right? And I think we saw in 2016, understandably, because we hadn't seen some of that behavior before, we thought, well, you know,
If we point that out,
that's going to be enough, right? And I think that what we all should have learned over the last several years is that it is an advantage for our candidates to be decent and thoughtful and well-informed and all those things. And I think we've done a great job recruiting tremendous candidates for Senate, governor's races, on down the ballot. So that helps, right? And that should give us an advantage. But we shouldn't assume that in any given election, it's a character test alone. We are going to have to engage in the issues and make very concrete arguments to people that, look, if you have a Democratic majority, then you're more likely to make sure that you know, you're getting paid a living wage, and that you have basic protections on the job, and that if you're still going to school, that it's going to be affordable, and you know, if you get a job that doesn't give you healthcare on the job, that you're going to be able to afford to get healthcare through the Affordable Care Act. And the subsidies are going to be ones that, you know, allow you to keep some money in your pocket. You know, those are the kinds of arguments, I think, that ultimately we still have to make, even when just by how we act and how we behave, we're also modeling, you know, a better way of doing politics.
So one challenge that the Democratic Party has had since you left office is we keep doing worse with voters who don't have a college degree.
Right.
And at first it was white voters.
Right.
And the theory behind that was perhaps racial resentment was driving that. Now we're seeing Latino voters without college degrees leaving the party or voting Republican, and even some black voters as well. New York Times just ran a story about the 250-page unpublished manuscript that you wrote in law school.
Yes, this was very random.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
One thing you guys know about me, I've been pretty consistent. You know,
That's what I took away from reading it, yeah, and reading the story about it, is you basically argue that Democrats need to make appeals that are based more on class than race if you want to build a durable, right, majority. How do you think about that in light of the party's current predicament today?
Look, I mean, I have watched with great pride this country become more aware of the force of racism and sexism and homophobia in everyday life. And I think that movements like Me Too and Black Lives Matter have changed the culture in all kinds of positive and powerful ways. You know, speaking as somebody who's got two black daughters, right? I want them to feel as if, as they move through the world, that they're not having to put up with a bunch of nonsense that if I had a white son, which biologically might be difficult, that they'd be treated fairly, right? But I also think that when we're talking about putting together, as you said, durable majorities, we have to be able to speak to everybody about their common interests. And what works for, I think, everybody is the idea of a basic equal treatment and fairness. That's an argument that's compatible with progress on social issues and is compatible with economic issues. I think where we get into trouble sometimes is when we try to suggest that some groups are more, because they historically have been victimized more, that somehow they have a status that's different than other people, and that we're going around scolding folks if they don't use exactly the right phrase, or you know, that identity politics becomes the principal lens through which we view our various political challenges. And to me, I think that for a lot of average folks ends up feeling as if you're not speaking to me and my concerns, or for that matter, my kids' concerns and their future. It feels as if I'm being excluded from that conversation rather than brought into the conversation. And so that's something that you know, we all have to be mindful of and cautious about. But I want to emphasize here, you know, throughout my presidency, there was never a time in which we shied away from making strong arguments on behalf of groups that had been historically subjugated in this country, and we didn't ignore history. But there was always an invitation to people to say, you know what, I think all of us, regardless of what your status is, want fairness and want equality and want your sons or daughters to be treated fairly and with respect and dignity. And the more we're leaning into those arguments, and the less we're leaning into an argument that says deserving of consideration and you guys are the problem, however you wanted to frame you guys. Yeah, I think most people don't want to be lectured to in that way. And I think that can cause us some difficulties.
So one thing that's also happened is we've seen Republicans try to take advantage of this, kind of damage the Democratic brand in some way. And in the last few elections, we've seen that Democratic policies like Medicaid expansion, raising the minimum wage, those things have like a 15-point advantage over Democratic politicians who would want to pass them. What do you see as you just talked a little bit about it, but like, how do we close that gap, right? How do we get people to listen? They seem to be more able to listen and get past polarization and misinformation when it's on the policies, not the politician.
Well, I think it is connected to what we just talked about. And listen, I think it's important for us to acknowledge that what Republicans and conservative media have done very cleverly is to find whatever the most outrageous examples of overwrought cancel culture is, and they'll flash it on the screen as if this is the Democratic Party platform. And and because they understand this dynamic that we just talked about, right? The message they sell day in, day out is these effete coastal liberals are looking down on you and think you're stupid. And so as a consequence, whatever they say, they don't mean it, because all they care about is keeping you down and lifting themselves up. And so in light of the fact that that is constantly in the air that Republicans breathe and voters oftentimes are exposed to, we got to bend over backwards sometimes to counteract that in order to get people to hear about policy. I mean, I think there's a reason why a guy like Fetterman in Pennsylvania has done well among voters that some other Democrats might not have done well with, because he comes off as a regular guy, right? And every once in a while, he says something that it's a little, off script. If he was given a speech at, on a college campus, people might be, aghast. And that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing, right? I'm not suggesting that, every candidate has to be themselves. And nothing's worse, as we've all seen in the past, of, folks trying to, be down with the people. And,
I think it rules. I love it when they try.
It's a little awkward and stiff. But all of you guys were also, with us when we were on campaigns and I was in places that a lot of folks thought I could not get votes because of my biography. But I think what people sensed was, oh, this guy relates to us, right? He gets us. And that quality is something that I think Democrats have to embrace and claim. And I think we do get into trouble. Look, I used to get into trouble whenever, you guys know well, whenever I got a little too professorial and, started when I was behind a podium as opposed to when I was in a crowd, there were times where I'd get, sound like I was given a bunch of policy gobbledygook. And that's not how people think about these issues. They think about them in terms of, the life I'm leading day to day. How is it even relevant to, the things that I care most deeply about? My family, my kids, work that gives me satisfaction, having fun, not being a buzzkill, right?
That's a lesson for the Democratic
Party. Yeah, and sometimes Democrats are, right? It's like, sometimes, people just want to not feel as if they are walking on eggshells, and they want some acknowledgement that life is messy and that all of us at any given moment can, say things the wrong way, make mistakes. Michelle talks about her mother-in-law, or her mother, my mother-in-law, who is a extraordinary woman. But as Michelle points out, she's 86, and sometimes, trying to get the right phraseology when we're talking about issues, Michelle's like, that's like her trying to learn Spanish. It doesn't mean she shouldn't try to learn Spanish, but it means that sometimes she's not going to get the words right. And that's okay, right? And that attitude, I think, of just being a little more real and a little more grounded is something that I think goes a long way in counteracting what is a systematic, the systematic propaganda that I think is being pumped out by Fox News and all these other outlets all the time.
I don't know that you know this, but we used to joke that you would always insist on saying that the Recovery Act was divided into three parts. And we used to think, oh no, he's going down the Recovery Act is divided into three parts thing again.
I feel terrible about that now. And, you know, I'm sure that's why we got clobbered in 2010.
I just want you guys to know that we talked about that in the last interview that we did at the White House.
Oh, man. Well, it's been a long time. Well, I think it's worth repeating.
Clearly, Lovett's been traumatized by this whole thing.
I think about it sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. You brought up Fetterman. I mean, Fetterman saw something in your campaign in 2008 because I think he was like the only elected official in Western PA that endorsed us.
That's exactly right.
And do you think he's doing, what do you like about him? Is it the look or is it the, like?
Look, you know, words like authenticity get overused, but the thing I love about Fetterman, and you see it in a lot of our other candidates, is you feel as if when you're talking to them that you're having a normal conversation and they have some sense of how the rest of America lives.
Yeah.
Right.
Grounded. Not a lot to ask.
It's pretty basic, right? You feel as if that guy walked into a diner, sat down and you started, you know, talking about whatever issues came to mind, that you might not agree with everything he said, but you'd feel as if he had a point of view that was informed by his real life experiences, that he was honest about what he believed, that he'd be open to potentially changing his mind if, you know, you made a good argument, that there are certain values that he cares about, and that he cares about people. Right. Now why it is that those qualities don't seem to always apply to successful Republican candidates, what's going on there, I don't know exactly. But I suspect, and I've talked to you guys about this before, again, it's the degree to which conservative media just has a lock on how people are presented, and sort of the dominant narratives there are so powerful that, you know, people will vote for DeSantis, even if I'm not sure that they would really have a great time.
He does not seem like a lot of fun.
No. Hanging out with that guy.
I think that's going to be a problem for him. It's going to be a problem for him. You know,
a weird robot.
You can't just sound like Trump.
Do you want Trump without the charisma?
Yeah. A couple of them have tried that.
Yeah.
He's a real piece of work. If you guys will forgive me, I wanted just a couple international questions.
Yeah, man. Look. Okay, thank you. You know, you count too. You matter.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
As seamless as the transition in the State of the Union. As we are strong at home, so are we strong in the world. And then we're off.
Two things and back the economy.
You got two lines.
All right. Sorry, this is every day.
Right. You were fighting this battle.
Listen, thank God for Ben. I saw that you, Michelle, put out a statement in support of the Iranian protesters earlier this week. I was just wondering why you thought it was important to weigh in and if you think there's lessons we can learn from the Green Movement in 2009 or the Arab Spring about which of these democratic movements succeed and fail and why.
I think there's no way to predict how this plays out. And one thing we all learned through the Arab Spring, the Green Movement in Iran and a lot of other places is that you can't underestimate the power of just sheer force and violence, sadly, and the repressive mechanisms that a government like Iran has in place. But there are a couple of conclusions we can draw from. Number one is that there is deep dissatisfaction with the Iranian regime. Number two, that women in particular are chafing under a series of not just systematic discrimination against women and subjugation of women, but also an arbitrariness and cruelty beneath that's exercised by the state against women, which has made them essentially say, we're fed up, we're tired of this. And that's extraordinarily powerful. Whether it ends up bringing about fundamental change in that regime, I think is hard to predict. But I, you know, the one thing that, you know, when I think back to 2009, 2010, you guys will recall, there was a big debate inside the White House about whether I should publicly affirm what was going on with the Green Movement, because a lot of the activists were being accused of being tools of the West, and there was some thought that we were somehow going to be undermining their street cred in Iran if I supported what they were doing. And in retrospect, I think that was a mistake. Every time we see a flash, a glimmer of hope, of people longing for freedom, I think we have to point it out. We have to shine a spotlight on it. We have to express some solidarity about it. That doesn't mean, by the way, that the administration is that a U.S. administration shouldn't be taking in a bunch of other equities into account. They have to. A president has to, right? So I continue to believe that the Iran nuclear deal was a really important thing for us to do to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Had we not had that in place, I think Iran would have had a nuclear weapon by now.
Well, look how well it's gone since we pulled out.
Exactly, right? So you still have to make decisions, often very difficult, about are there places where you do business with a government that is repressive? And that's the job of a president and an administration facing a complicated world. But our moral response to the incredible courage that is taking place in Iran and those women and girls who are on the streets knowing that they're putting themselves in harm's way to speak truth to power, we have to affirm what they do and hope that it brings about more space for the kind of civic conversation that over time can take that country down a better path.
Speaking of brutal, repressive governments, I mean, it's been 8 months, 9 months since Putin launched this invasion of Ukraine. I think everyone's been impressed with the way the Ukrainians have fought, how effectively they fought. I've been impressed with how much Europe has actually stepped up and supported them. The flip side of that success, though, is the fact that it appears that Russia is losing, or at least losing ground. Putin is getting pushed further into the corner. So I'm just wondering if you have thoughts for people who are watching this. They're inspired by the Ukrainian resistance. They want them to defend their country successfully, mm-hmm. but they're also pretty nervous about continued escalation and this chatter about, you know, Russia using a nuclear weapon.
I think what the Ukrainian people have accomplished is extraordinary. And it's a testimony to not just the courage of a few soldiers, but this is a entire nation mobilizing in the face of extraordinary odds, and making tremendous sacrifices. And Zelensky himself has risen to the moment in a way that, you know, his biography would not have necessarily anticipated. Right. So, at the end of the day, it is not our job to tell the Ukrainians when is it enough, how far should they go, you know, what concessions should they make, mm-hmm. etc. That's up to them. As their allies, it is important for us to support them financially, militarily, through our intelligence. We do have, however, to be clear and honest with them about what we can and cannot do. And there are lines that we have to determine internally, the U.S., NATO, and others, that take into account the risk of this tipping into a Russia-U.S.-NATO conflict as opposed to a Russia-Ukraine conflict. I'm not privy to enough of the intelligence at this stage to, and it's not my job as a private citizen to weigh in on where that line should be drawn. But as we're thinking about, for example, what weapons we're sending in or how we're approaching our support for Ukraine, I think thinking about where defense stops and offense begins and how we manage that is something that we have to pay attention to. And I do think, you know, probably the thing that I'm most concerned about is that lines of communication between the White House and the Kremlin are probably as weak as they have been in a very long time. Even in the in some of the lowest points of the Cold War, there was still a sense of the ability to pick up a phone and work through diplomatic channels to send clear signals. And a lot of that is broken down, and I don't think it's the fault of our administration. I think that we're now dealing with a type of Russian regime that is actually even more centralized, even more isolated and closed off. I think Putin has consolidated decision-making to a degree that we haven't seen, even during the Soviet era. And that, I think, creates some dangers and us finding ways in which some of that communication can be reestablished, I think, would be important.
As we defend democratic values abroad, we defend them here at home.
Oh, okay.
Well done.
God.
We back?
I mean, that I think was a little better. I have to admit.
So one of the things you've said since leaving office is it's your job to kind of step back and allow a new generation of leaders to emerge. Did you intend on that to be the silent generation?
All right. So you were just saving that joke, basically.
Yeah, it's typed up. No, the real question is, you know, yes. when we talked a couple of years ago, you pointed to young people that you were excited about. Are there young leaders that are inspiring to you, exciting to you that you're seeing?
Yeah, look, one of the things I want to emphasize in this midterm is the importance of looking not just at the top of the ballot, but all the way down the bottom, because there are governor's races, secretary of state's races, state legislative races that are going to really matter. When we talk about how are we going to preserve democracy, particularly at a time when the current Supreme Court, to put it charitably, does not seem as invested in overseeing and stopping monkey business at the local level. It becomes that much more important for us to make sure that we've got quality candidates and we're supporting them and we're turning out for them at every level. Because it may turn out that in a close presidential election at some point, certification of an election in a key swing state may be at issue. And it's going to be really important that we have people there who play it straight. So I've seen a lot of talent that, there's a gap between the talent that's coming up. A lot of them are 40 and under. And then we have our national leadership that
over 40
is over 40. and
2X.
Why that gap exists, we can speculate, but the good news is I think there are a lot of talented members of Congress, young people. And I don't want to, the problem is if I start naming somebody, then, wow, you left me out. So I don't want to do that. But if you look at the talent that's in Congress right now, young, dynamic folks who are willing to shake things up, it's really impressive. And it's just going to be a matter of them continuing on the path they're on and then making that leap where they start getting national attention. I think it's a little harder now to break out nationally than it was even when I was running, right? I mean, I give one keynote address and suddenly I'm pretty well known nationally. I'm not sure, and obviously the last one was during COVID, so we may not have tested this proposition yet, but whether with the splintering of the media, that's still possible, right? And so one of the things that I'm hoping to do over the next several years is in between elections, maybe bring together some of this talent and see how I can lift them up and support them. Because turns out I still have like a lot of Twitter followers,
and that's
more than
power.
Some people. Yeah. Although I don't really talk about it all the time.
Why do you think Gen X didn't run? Do you think it was grunge? What do you think happened? They just sat the whole thing out. It's weird. It's a little weird.
It's a little weird. There you go.
All right, you done?
Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah.
But I was supposed to keep it loose.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you. I feel loose.
You are the Supreme Court. Yeah. And in part for the very reasons you say, the Supreme Court is now held at its lowest esteem in history. Polls show that there's tremendous distrust. Voters say it's rigged. It's political. It doesn't represent the majority. Are you open to some reforms to try to address that challenge? Is there something we can do about that?
Because
we're kind of stuck with this Supreme Court for a while.
I'm open to it. I think it has to be thought through. One of the arguments we made at the time when McConnell decided that to invent a new principle that he then breached later about Merrick Garland and why the guy wouldn't even get a hearing or a vote is that if you start playing such explicit political games in the appointment process, it's hard for people not to feel as if this is just an extension of day-to-day congressional politics as opposed to the Supreme Court stands above, to some degree, those politics. And I think winning back that trust is going to take some time. And I'm not sure it's even going to be solved unless we solve some of the underlying polarization that that we've been talking about earlier. I know I've been talking for a long time about the fever breaking in the Republican Party.
It's on the bingo card.
Yeah, it's long polarization. It's long.
That was good. I like that.
That was good.
I'm under no illusions that some of those things are going to be fixed anytime soon. But I do think that if we reform the Supreme Court simply by figuring out ways to get more Democrats on there and stack it up, then it's not going to solve the legitimacy problem of the Supreme Court. It's just that we'll win more cases for a while, which as a partisan, as somebody who thinks there's a right way to think about women's reproductive health, that there's a better way to think about equality for the LGBTQ plus community. You know, it would be, I would much prefer us winning 5-4 than losing 6-3. But what I'd like even more is for us to find ways in which we can get to a point where justices bring their own perspective to bear, but are willing to actually look at precedent and look at how society is moving and are making judgments not based on a bunch of rigid ideological criteria, right? The last point I'd make on this, and this was actually weirdly in my, law school paper that recently got...
You got to publish that thing.
No, I will not.
Money in the banker.
But I do think that it's important for progressives not to count too much on the courts. One of the problems with Roe was that it did make, I think, a lot of voters complacent, figuring, do I really have to trudge over and vote in some obscure midterm election? Because I know that the Supreme Court is protecting me when it comes to my right to choose, right? And I think that we have to be mindful that even if we have a independent, thoughtful Supreme Court that's not entirely ideologically driven, it's still part of our democracy. It's still reflective of our politics. You have to still do the work on the ground of changing people's hearts and minds and attitudes about issues, because the court generally follows societal trends more than it leads. It's very rare where the court gets ahead of society in a significant way. It typically reacts and responds. And more often when it's gotten ahead, by the way, it's done bad things rather than good things. Brown versus Board of Education, Roe versus Wade, maybe two exceptions. But even after those decisions, right, it's not as if the issue was settled and politics went away, as we've just learned, right? So there's no shortcuts here. We have to work. We have to get out. We have to vote. We have to be engaged in conversations. We have to reach into places where the majority of people don't agree with us on these issues, and we have to make a case. That work never stops. The thing I worry most about during these midterms, and this happened throughout my presidency and pretty much every Democratic presidency, is that our Democratic voters get real hyped up around presidential races, and we lose interest a lot of times during midterms. And then we're puzzled as to, why isn't more stuff happening, And then we use the fact that more stuff isn't happening as an excuse to not vote again in the midterms. And look, anybody who's listened to your podcast, I'm preaching to the choir, I'm assuming. But for those of you who are listening and have friends whose attitude is, I'm so progressive that I don't bother voting because, it's all just a neoliberal, plot. Keep in mind that, let's say, the climate provisions in, the big Biden administration bill. They're not going to solve climate problems. Temperatures are still going up. The planet's still warming. But, it makes a big difference whether the planet goes up 2% or 3% or 4%. That might be billions of people who are displaced or not displaced. That might mean entire cities that are flooded or not, and you know, may make a huge difference in terms of you know, our capacity to manage these changes that are taking place. So if you vote, and we've made it more likely that temperatures rise 2.2% rather than 3%, that's got to be worth 15 minutes of your time.
Seems like a good thing,
right?
Yeah.
It has to be. You know, the same is true when it comes to issues like racial justice. Is your vote going to eliminate racism or problems between police and communities of color across the country? Probably not. But you know what? It could mean a different DA someplace. It could mean the difference in terms of making an investment in diversion programs that give kids a chance and don't simply lock them up for 20 years. And that's got to be worth 15 minutes of your time. And then you can continue to work for a the broader vision that you're looking for. But I do get frustrated with an attitude that I'm too cool to vote. That you see floating around the internet a lot among folks who purport to be progressive. And I can't wrap my head around that argument, because it's not as if these folks who are, you know, on social media making this argument are out leading the revolution, right? They're not. They're on social media.
They're not knocking on doors.
They're not knocking on doors. Well, but you know, they are not offering a plausible alternative course of action. This is the game we have. This is the power we have. And it turns out that power is pretty significant. Will it get us all the way to the promised land? No. But that's, you know, how things get better. And, you know, not to repeat myself, but better is good.
Better is good.
How has the current political crisis that we're in changed the way you are thinking about your post-presidential role in public life?
It certainly changed the first 4 years, right? Where I was probably more active politically than I would have anticipated. There's a little bit of, I admire the, you know, Cincinnatus, you know, George Washington going off, you know, I'm a private citizen now kind of vibe.
I always use the Cincinnatus reference as well.
Yeah, thank you. You're constantly talking about that guy.
But I thought that the stakes were high enough during the 4 years that my successor was in office that I was more vocal and still tried to pick and choose my spots, but was more engaged and involved. Obviously, with Joe Biden in the White House now, I've been trying to refocus my attention on this, what had always been my original intention, which is to focus on developing the next generation of leaders through the work we're doing at the foundation. The one thing that probably I'm more attuned to now is trying to make sure that as we're working with young leaders through the foundation, that we're maybe a little more explicit about the democratic values that are at stake. And I'm becoming more interested in working with folks, partnering with organizations that are experimenting with ways in which we can strengthen our democratic muscles, right? So issues like misinformation and how do we create a social media environment that in which facts and reason and logic at least have a shot, and go beyond sort of the 60% of the country that already occupies that space and is able to reach the 40% who consume most of their news through Fox or you know whatever the latest you know radio host is or podcaster is on the right because I know those folks. You look at a place like Iowa, right? And what's changed there? It's the same people, right? It's not fundamentally different. They're just getting a bunch of different information, and so the filter is so thick that if I were to go back into the exact same communities, it'd be a lot harder to get a hearing, right? And so how media works, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about what are the tools we can develop to crack that code. I think part of what we talked about earlier, you know, how do we think about pluralism and culture in a smarter way so that we preserve the gains and continue to advance that we continue to, whose phone is that? Okay. I'll bet it's Lovitz.
It's fine. It's mine. It's fine.
how can we train folks, young leaders to be able to champion, the rights of, you know, racial minorities and people of different sexual orientations and women, but have a language that is inclusive and makes people feel as if that we're assuming the best in them and not the worst, right? That becomes interesting to me. So I think I'm spending more time thinking about the building blocks of democracy and where we've seen it break down. You know, where have been the cracks in the foundation that need to be shored up, and are there ways in which I can be helpful in shoring those up? And that's just to bring poor Tommy back into the conversation.
Thank you.
There is.
See, you know, that's where I do think there is a through line between what's happening here in the United States and countries around the world. I mean, you look at what's happening in Europe. You look at the Italian election. You look at the recent French election. You look at these far right parties that are popping up in Scandinavia,
Sweden, right? Viktor Orban.
Yeah, right. And obviously Hungary's. We've seen over the last several years, in all these places, right? What you're seeing is that, if you define democracy just as elections, that's not enough. There's an infrastructure that has to be built, and a set of values that have to be transmitted. And that how we thought about globalization and trade and immigration and all that stuff, that how not in some cases the actual policies, but certainly how we communicated that to voters throughout some of the wealthiest countries in the world, didn't work, didn't connect, right? And you see this rise of strongman politics that is dangerous. And it's not very different than what we've seen happening here through the Republican Party. So rather than just what elections can do, and the reason, again, that I'm on with you Jim Oakes, is you got an election coming up and you got to vote. And so that's the immediate short-term response to these threats is you have to, you know, get people in there who believe in the basic precepts of democracy and care about working people. But over the long term, there are some of these structural issues that we have not addressed, and they're still a problem. So, you know, to the extent that that I can be useful on that front, that's what I care about. I
think you can be useful on that front.
Maybe.
President Obama, thank you so much for sitting down with us.
This was good fun, guys.
This is great.
You know, yeah. I appreciate it. And, you know, you should invite me on more often.
Please.
Open invitation.
If you want to brainstorm this media stuff, we could get a Zoom going, just chat.
No, I'm not going to do that.
All right. That's funny.
All right, guys. It was great to see you.
Good to see you.
All right,
too.
Bye.
Perfect.
Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our senior producer is Andy Gardner-Bernstein. Our producers are Haley Muse and Olivia Martinez. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis sound engineered the show. Thanks to Hallie Kiefer, Ari Schwartz, Sandy Gerard, Andy Taft, and Justine Howe for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montu. Our episodes are uploaded as videos at youtube.com/podsaveamerica.